capacidades y derechos. El trabajo comienza ubicando liderazgos comunitarios como mujeres que ya no tengan antecedentes de trabajo en la comunidad, con mujeres que tengan un cargo público, presidentas de asociaciones de padres de familia, que tengan esta espinita de aprender y de organizarse. Las invitamos y las formamos. Les hablamos diferentes temas. Les hablamos sobre derechos sexuales y reproductivos, violencia y derechos humanos. Las indígenas mexiquenses no están ajenas al feminicidio, la muerte materna, la violencia familiar, pero tampoco a la falta de servicios básicos de comunicación y de transporte. Datos del INEGI dan cuenta de la realidad. En San Felipe del Progreso, las mujeres entre 45 y 49 años tienen un promedio de 5.8 hijos de cada 100 personas de 12 años y más. 39 son casadas y 15 viven en unión libre. Además de que cada 100 viviendas, solo 43 tienen drenaje. Al final, lo que buscamos es que ellas regresen a su comunidad ya formadas, ya un poco empoderadas en cuanto a los temas que manejamos y que sean ellas mismas las que compartan información con otras mujeres, que se conviertan en promotoras comunitarias, destaca Guadalupe. Este trabajo comunitario ha sido reconocido y este año la agrupación fue nominada a Global Prize 2015 Transformative Justice, que otorga el área de liderazgo y justicia social del Kalamazoo College, un centro universitario ubicado en el estado de Michigan, Estados Unidos. Milid fue de los 10 proyectos finalistas de la convocatoria que acogió propuestas de 82 países. En octubre pasado, Guadalupe y otra promotora viajaron al país vecino para participar en la ceremonia de reconocimiento. No obtuvieron el premio del jurado, pero ganaron el que otorga la audiencia. Los sueños son muchos, adelanta Guadalupe. La primera meta es organizar una feria sobre derechos sexuales y reproductivos. La segunda es consolidarse como organización, pero la más ambiciosa es que dentro de 4 años abran el primer refugio para mujeres víctimas de violencia para apoyar a las indígenas de la región. Y de esta manera llegamos al final de un programa más de Tiempo de Mujeres en Alternativa Latinoamericana, CFRU 93.3 FM, la radio comunitaria de la Universidad de Guelph en Ontario, Canadá, y por internet para el mundo en www.cfru.ca, así como nuestros blogs Mujeres por la Democracia, blogspot.com, y Alternativa Latinoamericana.blogspot.com. Se despiden de ustedes desde Colombia nuestro compañero y amigo periodista y activista Luis Alberto Castaño, con su equipo de colaboradores periodistas del colectivo de comunicación Radicales Libres, Silvia Oviedo, Marta Botero y Andrés Barbosa. Desde Sydney, Australia, la querida Daniela Villegas, periodista feminista y maestra en estudios de género. Desde mi adolorido México, en la península de Yucatán, la querida periodista feminista, colaboradora de Caos en la Red, Lorena Aguilar. Y desde esta cabina de radio, la queridísima Madeleine Speed, mi compañero Sergio Pochón y quien les habla, su amiga Hilda Venegas, nos despedimos deseándoles una noche con el deseo de justicia social para nuestros pueblos. Que si el presente es de lucha, el futuro es nuestro. Buenas noches y hasta la próxima.
Join us each week, Thursday evenings from 9 to 10 p.m. for Jazz Traditions. We'll highlight music from the 1940s through the 1970s, from Art Tatum to Zoot Sims. We'll occasionally have an interview or guest, too. That's Thursdays at 9 here on CFRU for Jazz Traditions.
Hi, I'm Handel, and I volunteer at CFRU because I love working with the people here, and I also love the feeling of contributing something meaningful to the world.
CFRU is always looking for new volunteers. No experience is necessary, and all the training is free. If you would like to get involved, email volunteer@cfru.ca.
Hi, my name is Jeff, and I love CFRU because it introduces me to all kinds of music I would otherwise not have heard. And there's a vending machine down the hall.
This is K-Train Fitzsimmons playing the heavily distorted chromatic harmonica. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
Attention comrades of Canadian DIY communities and underground art scenes.
This is our house, Weird Distro, the first and only not-for-profit online store for Canadian-made cassettes, LPs, CDs, and objet d'art.
One stop, one package, one massive country.
Run by Weird Canada volunteers.
For music to hold in your hands and your hearts, check out Weird Distro at distro.weirdcanada.com.
On two Saturdays in Guelph, December 5th and 12th, 2015, all women-identified people are welcome to attend Basic Women's Self-Defense with Wen Do. We are prioritizing women and girls of racialized, immigrant, migrant, and indigenous backgrounds to attend. Taught within a span of 15 hours would be practical and uncomplicated techniques to help escape from common scenarios that could possibly be encountered if attacked. Again, that's December 5th and December 12th, 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. on both days. Cost is $35 per woman if you register before November 20th. Full bursaries based on financial need are available. The regular cost is $150 per woman. Thanks to community sponsorships, this course is being subsidized for all women. Both the course location and content are wheelchair accessible. Contact Mary Carl to register at marycarlwendo@riseup.net. That's MaryCarlWendo at riseup.net.
Attention comrades of Canadian DIY communities and underground art scenes.
This is our house, Weird Distro, the first and only not-for-profit online store for Canadian-made cassettes, LPs, CDs, and objet d'art.
One stop, one package, one massive country.
Run by Weird Canada volunteers.
For music to hold in your hands and your hearts, check out Weird Distro at distro.weirdcanada.com.
Hello, my name is Arun. I host Navrang Guelph every Saturday, 11 a.m. to 12 noon on CFRU 93.3 FM. Each week, we bring Bollywood music in Hindi and Punjabi, South Asian masala and gup shop, and much more. So keep listening Navrang Guelph every Saturday.
I love my India. I love my India.
You probably didn't know that 3 out of 4 deaths by suicide are male. This Movember, do your bit to help men live happier, healthier, longer lives. Since 2003, funds raised during Movember have supported 1,000 men's health projects across 21 different countries, but there's still so much more work to be done. Help change the face of men's health. Sign up today at Movember.com from the 1st of October to the 6th of November and grow, give, and move by donating to Movember.com from the 6th of November to the 30th of November.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together.
The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate, only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world. A decent world that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
The people's flag is deepest red, it's shrouded off the mass of dead. And ere the limbs grew stiff and cold, their heart's blood died in every fold. Then raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. One hollow head in darkest night. It witnessed many a deed and vow. We mustn't change its color now. Raise the scarlet standard high. Beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. It well recalls the triumphs past. It gives the hope of peace at last. The banner bright, symbol plain of human rights and human gain. Raise the scarlet standard high. Beneath its folds we'll never die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. His mind's a fixed on health and place. The cringe beneath the rich man's frown and all that sacred emblem down. Raise the scarlet standard high. Beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
with heads uncovered, swear we all to bear it onward till we fall. Come dungeons dark or gallows grim, this song should be our parting hymn. Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and I want to welcome you back to the show. It was a wonderful show last week. I think it was very meaningful, where, of course, we had, in the wake of the horrific attacks in Paris, terrorist attacks in Paris, and the xenophobia and the racism that were unleashed by that, and the imperialist response to those attacks, which resulted in mass bombing of Syrian cities. You know, I was really glad that we had Brendan Campisi on last week, who was able to kind of unpack really what terrorism is in the modern context and just how, this wanton destruction, this mass slaughter of just anybody, of just people, for the purposes of instilling terror and intimidation and fear really is the province of the right wing, of reactionary forces in the world, who, of course, do not gain power by mobilizing the people. They gain power by suppressing the people, intimidating the people, making the people live in fear. And that is how they operate and historically have operated, whether that's in Italy or Ireland or the Middle East or wherever. You know, he unpacked all that for us. And so, of course, we see how terrorism and fascism really go hand in hand with regard to that. And, of course, imperialism finds them very, very useful. Now, it's interesting because, like, just obviously the show before last week's show dealt with the 98th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917. And just really what that – it's an interesting juxtaposition because – really what the Russian people did, you know, the peoples of the Russian Empire, not just the Russian people, did in 1917 is they rejected fear. You know, they rejected imperialism. They rejected empire. They rejected capitalism. They rejected the war. They rejected the First World War and the horrific slaughter it was visiting upon their land. You know, and asking them, as majority of whom were illiterate peasants, to go off and die, get chewed up on the battlefield for a basically a ruling class that abused them and exploited them, you know, and used them as cannon fodder in its wars. They understood that and they rebelled. They rejected that. I still say that the revolution that toppled the Tsar in February Revolution of 1917, which is a prelude, of course, to the Bolshevik Revolution and the fall of that year, was really the most successful anti-war protest in human history, given that the impact that it had on Russia, that it basically brought the government down, and really paved the way for an entire socioeconomic order to be brought to its knees. You know, that's really, really significant. And it just shows the power of the people when the people are actually mobilized, when the people reject fear, when they reject terror, when they reject empire. All these forces that are keeping them down, keeping them at bay, keeping them at war with each other, and they instead stand together in solidarity and fight back against their real oppressors. That's really what 1917 demonstrates in human history. There is another way forward. And of course, I think this is what we highlighted on the show last week. There is another way forward. And just like Charlie Chaplin said in the intro there, the speech which he gave in 1941, in his movie, The Great Dictator, you know, he was saying, like, you know, we have to fight for a better world, for a decent world. You know, and he outlined what that decent world is. And really, it all comes down. Basically, what he was outlining there is socialism. You know, a world where children would know no fear, where old age has security. When, you know, we do away with national boundaries and with bigotry and hatred and all this kind of thing, we actually build a society fit for human beings. You know, where human beings come first. Human needs come first. And where human potential can be developed. You know, and dreams realized and all this sort of thing. That's what socialism is all about. And it's only the power of the people that can bring that about. So what I want to read for you right now is a... This particular piece was written in March 16th, 1918, on the anniversary of the overthrow of the Tsar in Russia. And this was written by the great Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, and this is called One Year of History. He says, 1 year has passed since the day when the Russian people forced Tsar Nicholas to abdicate and take the road of exile. The commemoration of the anniversary is hardly merry. Sorrow, ruin, the appearance of collapse, the bourgeois counteroffensive with German bayonets and guns. Is the Russian Revolution finished? Has the proletariat in Russia failed in the greatest experiment in history? The look of things doesn't give comfort. The German generals have arrived in Odessa. The Japanese are said to be ready to intervene. 50 million citizens have been torn from the revolution, and with them the most fertile lands, the ways to the seas, the roads of civilization and economic life. The revolution was born in pain and despair and continues in pain and suffering, gripped in a ring of enemy power, immersed in an economic world refractory to its ideal, to its goals. In March 1917, the telegraphs announced that a world had collapsed in Russia, a world already ephemeral, the inanimate shadow of a power that was surging up, which was growing stronger, which dragged itself along with bloody violence, with the repression of spirits, with the torture of flesh torn to pieces. This power gave life to a huge state machine. 170 million human creatures were forced to forget their humanity, their spirituality, in order to serve. To serve what? The idea of the Russian Empire, of the great Russian state, which had to reach the warm and open seas in order to secure an outlet for its economic activity from every size of competitor, from the surprise of war. The Russian Empire was a monstrous necessity of the modern world. In order to live, to develop, to ensure a life of activity, 10 races, 170 million men had to submit to a ferocious state discipline, had to renounce their humanity and be pure instruments of power. In March 1917, the monstrous machine collapsed, rotted, decomposed by its congenital impotence. Men rose up, looked each other in the eye. Human values took the upper hand. Exteriority no longer had any value. Too much wrong had been done. Too much pain had been caused. Too much blood had been spilled. History, true history, had begun. Everyone wants to be the master of his own destiny, wants society to be molded in obedience to the spirit, and not vice versa. The organization of life in common in society should be expressed, should be the expression of humanity, should respect autonomy and liberty. The new history of humanity had begun. A new experiment in the history of the human spirit had begun. These coincided with the expressions that the socialist ideal had given to men's elementary needs. The socialists, as a political class, reached power without too much effort. The words of their faith coincided with the confused and vague aspirations of the Russian people. They had to make the new organization a reality, had to pass new laws, stabilize the new regulations. The past continued to exist, but it was falling apart. It gave the appearance of collapse, disorder, confusion. It seemed as if they were returning to barbarian society, that is, to non-society. The past continued to live beyond the land of liberty and sought vengeance. The new order was slow in being realized. Slow, skeptical, wicked man. It wasn't slow, for one doesn't remake society by fiat. Because the evil of the past is not an edifice of papier-mâché that is brought down in an instant. Life is a painful effort, a tenacious struggle against habits, against bestiality, and the coarse instincts that continuously make themselves known. A new human society isn't created in 6 months, when 3 years of war have exhausted a country, have deprived it of the mechanical means needed for a civil life. Millions and millions of men aren't organized in freedom just like that, when everything is against it and all that is left is the indomitable spirit. The history of the Russian Revolution hasn't been closed and will not close with the anniversary of its beginning. In the same way that a canto exists in the imagination of the poet before it does on the printed page, the arrival of a new social organization exists in consciousness and wills. They are changed men. This is what is important. They want exteriority, the words on the page. They cry out at every failure, at every apparent reverse. Historians ask of the Russians what has never been asked of past revolutions, the immediate creation of a new order. They devise plans that have never existed, hopes that have never been dreamed of, and these plans, these hopes confront a current reality to end in failure, in collapse, with a reality that is said to issue from a year of new history, but which issues from centuries of the most bestial repression in human history. The impossible is asked of them, which has never been asked of men in the past. How many times did the French Revolution see Paris occupied by the enemy? And the occupation came after Napoleon had dictatorially organized the revolutionary forces and led the French armies from victory to victory. And France was a small thing compared to the exterminated Russia. No mechanical force has ever prevailed in history. It is men. It is consciousness and the spirit that molds external appearances and always triumphs in the end. A year of history is closed, but history continues. Antonio Gramsci, 1918. And history in the Soviet Union indeed did continue. As I mentioned weeks ago, you know, how 14 armies invaded Russia after the revolution of 1917 to suppress that revolution, to try to turn back the clock to restore the old order. And of course they failed. The people of Russia resisted them and they emerged victorious. They continued building their new society. They continued building their new society and their new way of life, and the first socialist state took shape. And the victories that it won, you know, were just astounding. They amazed the world at what human beings were capable of. You know, if we just look at the changing conditions for women in the USSR, in Russia, a society that before 1917, women were in bondage, and most of them were completely illiterate. Literacy rates among women were almost 90%. And yet, they were leading the charge for societal change. By the 1930s and 1940s, women were in every industrial sector, in every sector of the economy. They were putting their skills to use. They were being educated. They had rights that women in the rest of the world, in many cases, had never even dreamed of. You know, economic rights, political rights, rights to their own bodies, control over their own bodies when it came to abortion and birth control. You know, and of course, they couldn't be denied employment if they were pregnant. You know, they had these rights, rights to employment. You know, the new socialist state was campaigning against patriarchy and patriarchal attitudes, and was doing it through industrialization and collectivization of agriculture. Women's committees were forming in every workplace, in factories, on farms, you know, in offices, you name it. You know, and in many cases, the most reactionary, the most backward areas of the country, where women, of course, had been treated tantamount to property in places like Uzbekistan and Georgia and places like that, women were leading the charge, and they were witnessing the most progress against forms of gender oppression in those countries. You know, women were really leading the charge for change, and change was really happening in a substantial way. You know, we saw how by 1970, the USSR had more female engineers and doctors than the entire rest of the world put together. You know, this is significant stuff. You know, in Soviet school textbooks, were portraying women as construction workers, as driving heavy equipment, engaged in engineering, and as doctors, and as astronomers and scientists, and cosmonauts, and, you know, exploring space, you know, all these different jobs, which women, you know, the stereotypes all said women couldn't do, but women were doing that in the Soviet Union, and they were getting the recognition. They were, you know, they were being portrayed in these roles, you know, and school children were growing up understanding that women could do all these things, you know, and it was portrayed, you know, they were given credit for this. It was seen as normal. This is something that was, the stereotypes were being combated and torn down. And certainly by the 1970s, I mean, amazing progress had been made. You know, and I've talked about this on previous shows, how people who under the Tsarist Empire had been illiterate peasants, you know, and oppressed and downtrodden factory workers, you know, their children under the Soviet Union, like, were able to gain an education. They were able to gain education. They were able to gain skills. They were able to gain access to employment and rise to undreamed of heights. You know, 80% of the top posts in the USSR's economy and politics, 80% of them by the 1970s were made up of people whose parents had been peasants and manual laborers. You know, all these people realizing their potential as human beings, developing themselves, taking access to free education. You know, and, you know, and learning and becoming all that they could be. None of which was possible under the old order in Russia. You know, all of these things were being realized under the Soviet Union, under socialism, where, of course, human needs, a society where human needs came first, not the profit motive. You know, this is serious. This is crucial. You know, and this is something that I will continue to drive home on this show because, of course, it's just not mentioned in this society where, of course, in many cases, people have no hope that a better alternative way of living is even possible. Or even if they think it is possible, they're confused about what it entails and how to get there. You know, they don't know that it has been done in history, in human history, and that this is not rocket science. It doesn't entail reinventing the wheel. All that it entails is human beings standing together and working together and fighting together and overcoming those barriers and those structures of oppression and exploitation. You know, and fighting for a better world, building that better world, restructuring society and creating a society that is in their image. Their image is working people, not in the image of the exploiters and the capitalist class who, of course, live off of other people's labor. You know, this is the way to bring about change. It has to be systemic. We can't just look at the symptoms of the problems in society. We have to go to the root cause. This wicked system, this evil system that makes men torture, that beats us down, that beats human beings down and exploits them and uses them and treats them as cannon fodder and, you know, treats them as tools to be exploited to great profit for a parasitical ruling class. You know, that is what we're up against. And unless we address that, we're not going to see real change. We're just going to be running around in circles. You know, we have to understand that. You know, and we have to take heart from the past examples, the past victories that have been won. And dramatically so. Dramatic victories have been won all around the world. You know, societies from Russia to China to Cuba, Grenada, Vietnam, Angola, Mozambique, you know, and many, many others have shown what can be accomplished when human needs are placed before profit and when structures of exploitation and oppression are broken and where human beings are empowered to be all they can be, to develop themselves as people, as human beings. Develop their potential. You know, this is like This is what we need to aim for. You know, we need to take our cue from them as we try to build change here and now. You know, and we need to take inspiration from those heroic figures in revolutionary history, such as Lenin. You know, of course, he did not do it alone by any means, but he was a symbol for those people who rose up in 1917. He was a symbol. He was an inspiring symbol, like embodying these principles that they were fighting for. And he inspired people all around the world, millions upon millions of people. They still know his face, his image. You know, and they know that he symbols a different way forward, a way forward where working people, you know, can be all they can be. They can build a society for themselves, be masters in their own house, you know, have control over their own lives instead of submitting to exploiters, you know, whether that's capitalists or feudal lords or what have you. You know, they can build, working people can build a society for themselves, you know, and defeat colonialism and defeat empire and defeat capitalism. All of this can be done. Lenin really embodied that. So that's why I'm going to play this next song, which is called Lenin is Young Again. Lenin, Kakoi Mwaladoi. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Небо утреннего стяг, жизни важен первый шаг. Слышишь, веют над страною ветры яростных атак. И вновь продолжает собой, и сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. Весь летит во все концы, вы поверьте нам, отцы. Будут новые победы, станут новые бойцы. И вновь продолжает собой, сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. С неба милости не жди, жизнь для правды не щади. Нам, ребята, в этой жизни только с правдой по пути. И вновь продолжает собой, и сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So you're just listening to Levchenko with Lenin is Young Again, from Soviet State TV, actually. And that particular recording is very interesting. The Russian is Lenin Kakoi Malodoy, so Lenin is Young Again. And really what that kind of signifies is the fact that Lenin as a symbol is forever young. I mean, you know, people will be inspired by him, you know, long after he has, you know, long after his death. You know, he remains a potent symbol of revolution and what human beings can, working class human beings can accomplish when they rise up and restructure society and like make it serve their interests, you know, as, you know, as the people, you know, makes them serve their interests. And Lenin, his image shows that that can be done. And it's still a very important, a very potent image to this day. You know, just like the image of Che Guevara and Fidel Castro and Mao Zedong and all these other people, like they're still symbols of revolution. They're still symbols of what people can accomplish through their collective efforts, you know, against the forces of fascism and imperialism and capitalism. You know, they show what can be done, and they still inspire. And so really that's what that song's about. You know, that song is about that inspiration that these revolutionary figures still have in the world today. Now, and of course, we also played a piece of instrumental music from Georgi Sviridov called Time Forward, talking about the progress being made in the Soviet Union economically and socially and politically and all these different ways that working people are building a new society. And that piece of music really embodies that spirit, that progressive spirit moving forward. Now, I want to make an announcement just for you right now. A friend of mine is running a two-day basic Wendo women's self-defense course here in Guelph, Ontario. I'm going to give a shout-out to her and just announce what it's all about. So the announcement says, all self-identified cis and trans women and girls are welcome to this course. Women of indigenous, migrant, newcomer, and other marginalized racial and ethnic backgrounds are especially encouraged to attend. This is an empowering self-defense course for all women of all abilities. Within this 15-hour class, you will learn practical, effective, and uncomplicated techniques to help ourselves escape from common scenarios that could possibly be encountered if attacked. Explore verbal self-defense, reasoning, confronting, using surprise, and more. Discuss issues of violence against women and girls in a supportive setting, and share inspired real-life stories of resistance. So the dates are two Saturdays, December 5th and 12th. 2015. The time is 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. on both days. The two locations are near York Road and Victoria Street North, and in Guelph, in downtown Guelph. And this course is wheelchair accessible. So the fee is $45. The early bird fee is $35. If you register before November 20th. And seeing this is on the 21st, I shouldn't have even announced that. The regular cost is $150. So thanks to community sponsorships, this course is being subsidized for all women. So to register or for more information, please contact Mary Carl at Mary Carl Wendo, all one word, Mary Carl Wendo at riseup.net. So that's all. Now, it still pains me to have to kind of announce that, but of course it is a reality that women are not safe in capitalist society. They have to find ways to defend themselves. This is one way they can defend themselves. They can come here, they can learn how to protect themselves against the violence which is regularly visited upon them, which of course does not get nearly the attention it deserves in the media, in common everyday discourse, you know, that actually, you know, these issues are not really being confronted. The fact that women are systematically abused, you know, they face abuse, they face violence, they face the commodification of their bodies under capitalism. You know, they are, they face stereotypes which degrade them and make them open to violence. And, you know, of course, this in particular is, this violence in particular is directed against women of color. You know, people that come from colonized, you know, marginalized communities. where, of course, the violence of imperialism is still regularly directed at them. You know, these are the kind of... These people do need to find ways of protecting themselves under this system, which does so much to abuse them. You know, they need these skills, unfortunately, to defend themselves. You know, and they have to be prepared to face violence at any time because it could happen to them. They know that. You know, and this is their daily reality. So once again, that's Mary Carl at, Mary Carl, that's MaryCarl, WENDO at riseup.net. If you want more information or if you want to register for that, that WENDO course. So it simply is a reality that marginalized and oppressed and exploited people around the world must defend themselves. That can include taking up arms to defend yourself, certainly in the case of people in Palestine or people in Syria. You know, of course, Syria is facing like basically an invasion right now by armed groups backed by Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United States and European countries that have been trying to overthrow the Syrian government and basically wreck Syrian society since 2011. And the people of Syria have been, not just in the Syrian army, but also in like Syrian national defense organizations, national defense forces, which are basically popular militias, which are, you know, people trying to defend their own communities. They've been taking up arms to defend themselves against these terrorists and these contra forces, basically, they've been invading and attacking them with foreign support, you know, and imperialist support. For years now, and that's led to the devastation of the country. They've had to fight back. The people in eastern Ukraine have had to fight back against you know, outright fascist militias that are backed by the Ukrainian army and by airstrikes and you name it. And of course, they're being trained by the United States and the EU. And of course, we also know what's going on in Palestine, where of course, increasingly Palestinians have been trying to use any means possible to defend themselves against the attacks of Israeli settlers who are armed to the teeth with, you know, with guns and just all kinds of equipment and the full backing of the Israeli army, you know, been like, you know, attacking them and burning down their orchards and, you know, just waging a campaign of terrorist violence against Palestinians. You know, that people in those situations have to protect themselves, you know, and they have to use any means necessary. And it's the same thing for African Americans or for indigenous people in this country. You know, they have to protect themselves. Sometimes they have to use violence to protect themselves. That's their reality. You know, women sometimes have to use violence to protect themselves, you know, given the violence that they face, you know. And ultimately, working people, you know, and this, of course, has come down throughout history. Ultimately, working people have had to take up arms against the forces that exploit them, the class forces that exploit them throughout history. They did that in 1917. That's largely why they were able to win, you know. So popular mobilization and resistance is a crucial thing. It's a crucial thing. And it has to happen at every level. You know, I mean, it was pretty mild, like what happened this week at the University of Guelph campus, where you had, African Canadians, like students of color, coming out and engaging in a Black Lives Matter protest on campus. Now, their demands were pretty mild. I would say too mild in a lot of cases. I mean, they just want representation in the university administration and in the faculties and this sort of thing. And for anti-oppression training to be normal on the campus. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, and I think, you know, examples around North America back this up, that really doesn't accomplish anything when it comes right down to it. I mean, really what that accomplishes is, okay, you have... you know, black people in positions of power and privilege, and they join in the power structure, and they ultimately become forces of repression. You know, they don't identify with ordinary African Americans and the kind of forces that they face on a daily basis. Now they're part of the power structure. It's the same thing when African Americans become police chiefs or, you know, or the president of the United States for that matter, or the justice secretary, you know, who supposedly is in charge of all police in the United States, or just police officers in general, or mayors, or positions of, they're in positions of authority. That doesn't mean the end to racism. in communities or in on college campuses or what have you. It just means that now you have some African Americans who are part of the establishment, part of the power structure, who will assist in beating down other black people and other people of color and this sort of thing. So it doesn't really change anything. And anti-oppression training, I mean, that's just not enough. You have to actually organize people. You have to mobilize people. You have to do all these things. This is really where liberalism falls flat on its face and why you need Marxist analysis, why you need socialism, why you need a systemic critique of society and the structures and the power structures which are in place in it, which reinforce racism and homophobia and violence against women and all these things. You know, unless you have that analysis, you know, you're going to be running around in circles chasing your tail. You know, you are going to fall flat every time. You know, you're not going to change the systemic reality that people face on a daily basis. You're not going to change the power structure that exists if you make these liberal demands. And, you know, and of course, I'm confident they will come to understand that of their own volition. You know, as they go forward, as they continue the fight, because of course they have no choice. They have to continue the fight. People from marginalized communities have to keep fighting. They have no choice in the matter. And as they continue fighting, they will understand what works and what does not work. You know, it was the same thing in the civil rights struggle. You know, so this is crucial. Now, going forward from this, I honestly wish I had an interview I could share with you about the situation in Syria. It's something I really want to talk about more often in upcoming shows. But I think if we want a good snapshot of imperialism, really what it does around the world, I think the interview which I did earlier this year with Joshua Tartakovsky about the situation in East Ukraine really captures a lot of the same kind of conditions which exist in Syria. Just in Syria, they exist on an even greater scale of destruction and violence. But really, the kind of forces at play in Ukraine right now are, in many cases, quite similar. So, and certainly, I think, and Joshua understands that. I mean, he, I think, brought this up in the interview itself. So I want to play that again on this show, just to once again bring it home to you, what imperialism does to society and the kind of forces it unleashes upon societies, and how people have to fight back against these things. They have to fight for their survival. They have to take up arms in many cases. They have to defend themselves and their communities and their families and all this sorts of thing, and their own bodies. You know, and this is crucial. You know, this is crucial. So I'm going to play that right now. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. So, okay, so you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And one of the stories which I have been talking about on the show quite a few times, actually, over the course of the past few years, of course, is the conflict in Ukraine, you know, with the Ukrainian government besieging the Donbass region in eastern Ukraine. So today on the show, I actually have the privilege of talking to somebody who has recently been to Donetsk People's Republic in eastern Ukraine, and kind of experience what things are like right there. So I'm going to be talking to Joshua Tartakovsky, right? Is that how you pronounce your name?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, that's good. And it's good to have you on the show.
Good to be on your show, Chris.
Okay, so basically where I want, and maybe you could just tell people when you were actually in Donetsk.
I visited Donetsk for several days towards the end of April in a trip organized by Europa Objective. Europa Objective, mm-hmm. whose goal is to, it's a German Russian civilian initiative whose goal is to introduce journalists, bloggers, and people of interest to the region so they take them to the Donetsk and explore the area.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so for those listeners who haven't been following the situation in Ukraine, maybe you could give just an overview of the conflict and how it began.
Okay, so this whole Ukraine crisis has been going on for the past, right now we're in June, and there was the coup in Kiev was in April, but there were protests even before then. So for the past almost a year and 4 months, even not nearly, even a year and a half, but it's been going on for quite some time. I would say events began, the general impression people had of when events were beginning were in the months of early 2014, were protesters in Kiev, many of them with different civil groups with fairly decent intentions were calling for the Ukraine to join the European Union and for President Yanukovych to step down. Now, the thing is, of course, it is fair to criticize President Yanukovych and for whatever reason. And at the same time, the demands of the protests at the time could have very well been legitimate. However, there's two points to remember about this issue. The first thing is that the U.S. was heavily involved in supporting this mobilization, but it also put at the forefront radical neo-Nazi groups mm-hmm. who were firing at the police and who hijacked the protests, and they were later placed in key government positions after the coup was successful in April 2014. In addition to that, according to several thorough investigations, for example, conducted by Professor Ivan Kachanovsky from the University of Alberta, if I'm not mistaken,
okay.
make a very clear case that snipers who fired at the protesters at Maidan in Kiev were hired by the opposition and were not. It wasn't President Yanukovych who fired at the protesters in Maidan. And what another major important thing to realize that people often do not have a good idea of is that Ukraine is a deeply divided country. It always has been and continues to be to this day. So it's not as if it's like one single entity, which we can say is Ukraine, where everyone has the same opinion and everyone would like